for the homeless man.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
I'm your host, Malik Johnson. Today we are joined with Dr. Les Roberts. Dr. Les Roberts is the individual researcher who led a team in Iraq, and he became prominent in the news just before the 2004 U.S. presidential election for his study estimating that 100,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed in the Iraq War at a time when official U.S. government estimates were much lower. In October 2006, an expanded follow-up study was released that gave a point estimate of 651,000 deaths having occurred in Iraq, within a 95% confidence interval from 300,000 to 900,000. U.S. President George Bush dismissed the new study, saying the approach had been, quote, pretty well discredited, end quote, without explaining much more. Numerous statisticians have supported the survey, and many have questioned the survey. Welcome to The People Speak, Dr. Roberts.
Thanks, Malik. Nice to be with you.
Did I get the introduction correct? Did I miss anything there?
You did, except that, you know, there's almost no one in the public health community that's critical of the method we approached. Most of the people who don't like it are our economists or political scientists or folks who aren't used to this sort of survey. But what we did was really the standard way of measuring the death toll in times of natural disasters and emergencies. And in fact, the U.S. government pays millions of dollars a year for a training program to train non-governmental organization workers and UN workers to do exactly what we did to measure mortality in times of conflict and hardship.
You did what is considered, you did a cluster sampling, did you not?
Yeah, so it turns out that when you're driving around in the middle of a war or you're in the middle of the jungle in the Congo, the getting from place to place is the dangerous and hard part. Whereas in America, if you want to do a public opinion poll, you'll just pick up your phone and randomly dial 1,000 people across the country. You know, in Iraq, in most war zones, you're just not going to have that liberty. So you've got to pick a neighborhood at random and then go visit it and pick some houses at random and visit them. So we tend to go grab a clump of houses in one place and then a clump of houses in another place. And it turns out that once you've gone to about 30 randomly picked places, even in a huge country, the more places you go to doesn't really increase the representativeness of your sample. So in 2004, we went to 30 places, and each time we interviewed 30 houses. Our results were a little bit crude that time. So in 2006, when our Iraqi colleague led the effort and we repeated the survey, we went to 50 neighborhoods and each time went to 40 houses. And came up, as you said, with an estimate that around 600,000 people had died as of last summer, so almost a year ago now.
You know, one of the things that struck me is when Tommy Franks said that the U.S. military did not quote do body counts. I'm just curious, what motivated you to take on this task?
Well, first of all, I've done this many, many times before in other wars, almost always in
Africa. In the Congo?
And knowing how many people have died is probably the most useful tool for stirring up compassion elsewhere in the world. You know, lots of things like loss of property and loss of family, when people see foreign cultures going through these hardships, they don't really fully understand what it means, but everyone understands what it means to lose a son or to lose a father. And so, for example, I did a survey in 2000 in the Congo, estimating that in the year and a half of war that had been going on there in eastern Congo, 1.7 million people had died. The week after our report was published, UN Security Council passed a resolution saying all the warring armies need to pull out. Within a couple of months, the amount of aid from the U.S. government to eastern Congo went up by almost tenfold. So going out and letting the world know how many people died can be a very, very effective tool for stirring up compassion, and that was our hope. When I went in 2004, I thought that I was going to be documenting the deaths due to all the indirect things related to war. In every war I had been in, except the genocide in Rwanda and Bosnia, in all the other wars, more people died of disease and malnutrition and hospitals not working than died of bullets and bombs. And I thought that was going to be the case in Iraq as well. And I was very wrong.
Most of the rise in death rate
was from violence.
You mentioned the Congo study, and it was interesting because once you did the Congo study, it appeared that rice, people pretty much accepted what you published. In fact, you're right, the UN Security Council, there was a resolution, and the UN pretty much requested $140 million in aid. No one had a problem. When you did the Rwanda study, nobody had a problem. I know you were the Rwanda, you were director of health policy at the International Rescue Committee. Why do you think people had a problem with this one, with this study of Iraq?
Well, I think you and your listeners know the answer to that.
I do.
Even more dramatic than you say. Tony Blair cited our Congo work on the floor of Parliament when the president of Congo came to visit, Joseph Kabila. Colin Powell cited our work in Washington to try to articulate the hardship that Congo was going through and how much America was dedicated to solving it. So it was very accepted. My work has been very accepted in the past. And I think in none of those conflicts that we discussed, Sierra Leone, Burundi, Congo, Rwanda, where I produced mortality estimates, in none of them was the U.S. government directly involved. And in fact, my agenda, ending death and suffering, was the U.S. government's agenda in each of those crises. So it was accepted because the message was acceptable.
Interesting. You say also that you were smuggled across the border into Iraq, and you said that you just had a suitcase and only $20,000 in your pocket. How did you manage to do that?
That's right.
And if you can do that, couldn't the terrorists so-called get in?
I didn't really know how stupid a thing I was doing while I was doing it. I think that's the main thing I had going for me. I flew to Jordan, and it was going to take me about a week to get a flight into Iraq. And I was not going to sit around Jordan waiting a week to get to work. So I talked to the concierge in my hotel. I said, I know there's lots of people who drive cars back and forth between Jordan and Iraq, and I'd like you to find me someone to take me back to Baghdad. And within a couple of hours, he found this fellow. And interestingly, this fellow was a former captain in Saddam's army. He had been in the military for more than 20 years. And then the Americans came, and suddenly he was out of work, so he was driving a car for a living. And he had a big white SUV with extremely dark tinted windows. I suspect he looted it from somewhere right in those days at the end of Saddam's era when the Americans first invaded. And so we sort of made a deal, and I think it was $200 that I would give him for driving me to Baghdad. Realized gas is very cheap there. And so we started driving, and there was some flat bread that you can buy in Jordan that you can't buy in Iraq, and he wanted to stock up on that as we drove by a bakery. So he pulled over to this bakery, and he went in, and he gets several big bags of bread, and he bumped into a friend of his, a guy that spoke English much better than my driver. And a friend of his comes out and comes up next to me in the car with my driver and says, "So you are an American doctor?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You are going to Baghdad?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You know, at border, some very, very bad men, very bad, Fallujah policemen, very bad. If they see you, I think this is not good. So when you get to the border, not the Jordan side, but the Iraq side, you must go in the back and lie down on the floor and just give your passport to your driver, and he will take care of everything." So as he suggested, when we got there, I went back behind the third and fourth seat and lay down on the floor, and the windows were very dark, as I mentioned. And my driver pulled up and went into the customs place, and he saw an old buddy of his from the military. And he walked up to him, and he pulled my American passport out of his pocket, and the guy's eyes got big, and he said, "What? You have an American here? Are you crazy?" And he sort of, I'm told, pushed his hand back so his passport went back in his pocket. He said, "You know, I don't know you. I don't know what you're doing, but good luck, you're an idiot." And suddenly my driver realized how stupid a thing he was doing. And he got really scared. And so he had his passport stamped, and we drove up to another point in the border area. And at one moment, a guy walked around the car and came up and put his hands right up against the window and tried to look in. And there I am. I'm lying on the floor looking up at him. But obviously the windows were so dark he couldn't see me. And then at a latter point in this border crossing, because the car had air conditioning in it when it was running, the customs guy got in the passenger seat up front and was talking to my driver for, it seemed like an eternity, but it was probably only a couple of minutes, with me lying in the back trying not to get seen. And when all was said and done, my driver talked, bluffed his way through. We drove up the road about a mile, and there was an old gas station off on the side of the road, and so he pulled out behind it. And my driver, I think, smuggled for a living. I think he was a pretty mischievous fellow. And he had an extra set of license plates and an extra set of documents. And in Iraq, like used to be the case in the United States, every province had a different colored license plate. So he took off whatever license plates he had on and put on a different colored set of license plates. And then he hid the old plates in his upholstery just in case he thought anyone had seen me or suspected something. That way, if they radioed ahead about a white SUV with black plates, he wouldn't have black plates and hopefully wouldn't get stopped. And so on we went, and we were only stopped one time on our way to Baghdad, and that was outside of the city of Fallujah. And just some militia stopped us, and I again hid on the floor in the back, and my driver bluffed his way through, and all went just fine.
And, so you're in Iraq.
Interesting aside.
I'm just curious.
As we're getting closer to Baghdad, after we've left Fallujah by just a little bit, I'm still lying on the floor way in the back to try to stay as unseen as possible. And my driver, who didn't speak much English, said, "Abu Ghraib, Abu Ghraib." And I sort of stuck my head up and I said, "Do you mean the prison?" And my driver nodded and he turned his head and looked back at me. And when I looked at him, I could see that he was crying. And, you know, here's this tough-ass former military guy. He has, I'm sure, in Saddam's army, been through some pretty tough things. But as he drove by Abu Ghraib prison, he wept. And it was, in my mind, quite a stunning demonstration of how profound the resentment over the Abu Ghraib abuse issues were among Iraqis.
Mm. Now, so you're emotionally moved too at this particular point in time, and you're now in Iraq. This is like a country.
Well, mostly I'm scared to death.
Yeah, you're scared.
That might
to death.
Be emotionally moved, but yeah.
How do you prepare for your survey? How was it? You know, you said in one particular interview, I think it was April 23rd, 2005. You were being interviewed, and you said that Americans are so hated that I couldn't go around talking to people. We could pick a town, we surveyed. How did you go about surveying? And we're so hated,
yeah,
as you say.
So the first thing we did was we got lists of how many people lived in each of the provinces. And we assigned our 33 clusters to those provinces so that the big provinces got a lot of visits, and or a lot of clusters, and the little provinces got proportionately fewer. So, for example, Baghdad, which is about one-fifth of the country, got about one-fifth, or I think six or seven, of the clusters. And some of the tiny governments that were just 500,000 people actually, by random chance, got missed. So we assigned our clusters with a sort of randomization technique that's just the standard way we do this in public health. And then once we got to the province level, if we were going to go visit one or two locations, we repeated that process, and we got a list of how many people lived in every village and area, and rural areas are referred to as villages. So they're sort of known populations by various areas within a province. And we assigned our clusters to them, again, at random. So the big places had a big chance of being visited, and the smaller chances, smaller places had a smaller chance proportionally. And then we went out to that village, or in some cases a section of a city, and we drew a map. We drove around that little village or that part of the city with one of those GPS units like you might use when you're camping or boating, and we measured how far it was east to west and north to south. And we made a very, very simple map, and we guessed where we were physically on the map, put a grid on that map, and picked two coordinates on that grid. And when we did that, we were then picking a place that was some distance in some direction away from where we were. And then we used that GPS unit to take us to that point at random.
So when we got to there, we
had the GPS tell us exactly where the point was, and we had then the GPS determined what were the 30 houses closest to that point. So it was not perfect, but about as close to random as we can do in most of these circumstances.
So you get into Iraq, you go through this with the driver, you set yourself up with the global positioning system, you draw a map of the town and
right.
drive.
There's a step
the
I missed
right
in there.
Point.
There's a professor in Baghdad that I had met over the internet, turned out to be the perfect partner for this. He didn't really understand all the fancy statistics and sampling methods, but he understood how things worked in Iraq. He understood how to get through checkpoints. He understood how to get political cover in case you were arrested. And he sort of laid all the groundwork politically and logistically, and then we picked our random villages and houses, and on we went. That's right.
So you have an interviewing team, and you say that that you had went out with the interviewers for the first 8 days. On the eighth day,
well, first eight clusters. That's
up,
right.
Yeah, picked up your interviewers, and you said it was a pretty
I'm sorry,
bad
I didn't
experience.
Catch your question.
The question was that you had an interviewing team. And you had gone out
That's
with your
right.
interviewing team for the first 8 days. On the eighth day, the police in Iraq picked up your interviewing team.
That's right. By random chance, we had the bad luck of knocking on the door of the governor's house in the city of Balad. And there I am. I'm sitting in the car, and I watch the police roll up, and my interviewers come out of the house, and they pile in the back of the police car, and off it goes. And, you know, this was a town very, very anti-American. There was a big picture of the cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, as you drove into town, and a picture of his father. These are like 40-foot-tall pictures as you drive into town. So it was abundantly clear who they sided with. And Muqtada al-Sadr is probably the most anti-American political figure in Iraq today.
Yes.
And so I was pretty worried that these folks would be arrested if they found out that I was there, that we might all go to jail or worse. And I told my driver I thought he should take me outside of town and leave me somewhere in the desert, and I'll just hide in case the police come looking for the driver in the car. And he said, no, I can't leave you, Les, cannot do this, no. So I hid my passport, and I hid everything that looked like it would have any documentation on it. My Iraqi colleagues had in advance produced some fake business cards for me that said I was Dr. Abdul Salam from the Bosnian National University. And by being Bosnian, that would explain how I could have blue eyes, look European, be bald, and still be a Muslim and be okay. You know, it was very cleverly thought out, and also why I wouldn't speak Arabic. And so I had my fake ID, my fake cards ready, and we sat it out. But in the end, the interviewers talked their way out of it. They came back. They didn't come back to the car. They just went right back to the houses and kept going until they had finished 30. They came back, and they were so shaken by this that I didn't go out with them again. I think we all realized that for them to be with an American is a little bit like being with a radioactive substance. It's just nothing but danger in it for them. And by the eighth round, these guys understood very well how to pick a random point with the GPS units and to pick the houses. So there wasn't anything that I was adding to the sampling process. And from that point on, all of the interviewers had they were almost all physicians. They all spoke English very well. So every night when the driver would bring me the data forms, if there was something on the sheets they had filled out that day that looked confusing or didn't make sense, I would call them up at home on the cell phone and say, Dr. Jamal, today you went to this house and there's a woman there now, but there was no woman in 2002. I don't understand what happened. And normally they could explain. If not, I'd give the data form back to them and they'd figure it out the next day. So I talked with them every day, but I never went out with the interviewers after that harrowing experience with the police.
Now, your survey, your conclusions seems to be that two-thirds of all violent deaths were in one city, Fallujah.
Well, so we, in 2004, came out with an estimate that we thought 100,000 excess deaths had occurred. When we did that, we set the Fallujah numbers aside. We didn't think that they were wrong, but the vast, as you say, about two-thirds of all the violent deaths we found were there in this one 30-house cluster in Fallujah. And if in 2004, in the fall of 2004, you had been watching the news, this would have been very plausible. First, there was that big incursion into Fallujah, I think in April of 2004, in which, because the press coverage was so negative for the Americans, they ended up backing off and pulling back out. And in the month or 2 months before we went in, the city had been surrounded by the American forces and was being shelled on a daily basis. So this was plausible that so many people had died, but we just didn't think that it represented a very big segment of Iraq, because the city of Fallujah was less than, let me just think about this, with just over 1% of the country. And the logic of our sampling, we were assuming every time we went somewhere that it represented 3% of the country. So we thought it would be to include the Fallujah cluster in our results. And so we put out this estimate, well, we think at least 100,000 or so have died, but with a qualifier. Because we had set Fallujah aside, we said if our number is wrong, it's probably wrong because it's too low. And I think that qualifier, while the right language for talking to statisticians, it just sounded really imprecise for members of the press. Kind of sounded like we didn't know what we were talking about. And I think that was some, not all, but some of the reason why that first study in 2004 got so little coverage in the American press. It was fascinating. It was on the front page of most of the major European and virtually all the Middle Eastern newspapers, and it barely got mentioned in the U.S. press.
Well, it was The Lancet that actually published it. I think on October 29, 2004. back to Fallujah, the Fallujah cluster, quote, indicates a point estimate of about 200,000 excess deaths in the 3% of Iraq represented by this cluster. The interesting thing is there was no confidence interval that was given for that point estimate, right?
Well, actually, if you just have a single point, you can't put a confidence interval around it.
I got you. I see.
Yeah, so we can imagine that that here we are. We're doing a survey wherever your listener is sitting. They walk out on the street, and they want to know what's the pulse of people in their town. And they measure the pulse of the first person at 72, and the next one 68, and 59, and 79. And they start to get this range with an average. And then imagine if around the 30th person, just by chance, they stop a speed freak. They measure his pulse, and it's 200. You know, you have to make a decision. Am I going to include that extremely different measure, that what statisticians call outlier, in my average or not? Well, if I've just measured 30 and I include that 300, my gosh, that will raise my average by, you know, several beats per minute. And maybe you think, well, in my hometown, 1 in 30 people is a speed freak. Or maybe you think this was a very unusual event, and if I sampled 100 more, I'd probably never find someone like this again. And, you know, so there's, we think when we do statistics and when we do sampling that it's all clean and there's no human judgment in it. But in this case with Fallujah, it just seemed unwise to allow one of 33 neighborhoods to determine 2/3 of the deaths. And so we didn't include it. And now that we've done the survey again, and now that there are a couple of other estimates out there, which I imagine we'll get to in the coming minutes, it seems that the death toll probably was higher than 100,000, but not a lot higher. So I think we probably did the right thing by just setting that Fallujah aside and using it to temper our language.
I thought at that particular time was rather conservative in estimate, and you all admit that it was conservative because you did exclude
the
illusion. Yeah.
It,
now, what about
right.
the second? What about the second survey, which was published on October 11, 2006? Did you pretty much use the same type of techniques?
Pretty much. By that point, the interview team was terrified about going around with a GPS unit. People thought, if they got stopped at checkpoints with a GPS unit, that either people might think it was a bomb detonator and thus kill them, or worse, they might think it was a GPS unit, a device which in Iraq is primarily used for targeting weapons, and thus kill them. So they were just not, under any circumstances, going to use the GPS again. So they did more or less everything the same, except they, when they got to a neighborhood and sort of drove around and saw the outline of the neighborhood, they sort of counted, they picked all the main streets and then picked one and picked the side streets off of them, picking one at random, counted all the houses on that street, picked one at random. So they had a slightly different randomization technique. But interestingly, when we look at that first 18 months, when the two surveys are surveying the same period of time, we have almost identical results. I think it was 112,000 excess deaths in the 2006 survey, and like I said, we thought 100,000 plus whatever Fallujah meant in the first survey. So the two results were very, very similar.
And you
so
got
we're
a
pretty
95%
sure that these methods didn't have any big biases in them.
Well, I'm sorry, Dr. Roberts, there may have been some overlap. But you had a 95% confidence interval between, I'll say approximately 400,000 to almost 1 million excess Iraqi deaths.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But realize when you come up with a confidence interval, the probability is it's near the middle. And so we're 90% sure that it was at least 100,000, pardon me, at least 500,000 as of last summer. And indeed, we're only 97% sure that it's 400,000. So, you know, as you move away from 600,000 or 650,000, that the probability that you get a result out at 800 or 900,000 is quite a bit lower than being around 600,000.
Well, to determine the number of deaths, you would have had to know how many people were there. Where did you find that information of the population for that?
We got it from two sources. We got it from, essentially, there's a Bureau of Statistics and the UN Development Program were each putting out estimates of how many people lived in each province, or as they call it in Iraq, governorate. And so we used the UN figures for assigning our clusters both to the provinces and to the individual cities or villages within the provinces.
Oh, I see. Well, you know that, and I'm pretty sure you're quite aware that the Lancet surveys that you've had it, the one in 2004 and 2006, apparently the 2006 in particular, your figures are much higher than those in most other major reports. For instance, the Iraq Body Count Project, the United Nations, and the Iraqi Ministry of Health. A lot of people have been quite critical of your particular work with the Lancet surveys. How do you respond to those who criticize? What has been the criticism of your surveys?
Well, there have been a couple. Paul Bremer's pollster called me up and interviewed me, and he said he was writing something for the Wall Street Journal to put these numbers in perspective, and I didn't understand that he was actually working for Paul Bremer at the time he interviewed me. And then he wrote this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that got a lot of attention. And it said, look at these guys. They only went to 47 neighborhoods. You can't possibly represent a whole country with 47 neighborhoods. And so that's one criticism that's out there. My answer to that is that, first of all, there is an overwhelming body of evidence in the statistical literature that going to more than 30 places is plenty. And secondly, we had a lot of violence in almost every neighborhood we went to. A couple in the Kurdish north, the rates of violence were low. But otherwise, the vast majority of neighborhoods were violence rates 10, 20, 50 times that seen in major U.S. cities. So going to so few places, our results are wrong. That implies that there are these little pockets out there somewhere that our sampling missed. And if we had just by chance hit one of those pockets, things would be really different. Well, the only way our result could be wrong, if that logic is true, is if our number is too low. Because you throw another zero into our neighborhood death toll distribution, and your average doesn't change virtually at all. The only way to change the average is, like with my example of the person with the pulse of 200, if you find somewhere where 20% of the population has died, well, that would move up the average a little bit. So that's one. Another one made by a psychiatrist, to the best of my knowledge, has never done any survey like this, but remarkably, it's gotten picked up in the press. She said, we couldn't have possibly done the surveys in the time allotted. Well, that's just absurd. Now, we went to 1,849 houses, and I forgot how many days, 40-something days. It works out to each interviewer only having to do 5 interviews a day. And these were really short interviews. It took longer to explain the study to people than it did to ask the 5 questions in our questionnaire. So
you know,
that's a pretty absurd one. So the bottom line is there have been some criticisms made, but none that give us any pause, none that make us think, oh, yeah, that seems really problematic. The most sort of valid criticisms are, A, that our results might be too low because people might have lied to us, or B, that there just don't seem to be the number of people injured that you would expect if 600,000 people had died. Well, I guess my response is that all of those criticisms that there should be 3 times as many people wounded as there are dead were developed in places like the Thai-Cambodia border and the Afghan-Pakistan border back before our invasion. And those are conflicts where landmines were the main killers. And in Iraq, people being shot by guns at close quarters is the main killer. And I just think these wars are different in nature, and that's why this criticism comes up. But there just have not been any major holes poked in this study, and there's evolving to be an overwhelming body of evidence out there that we're right.
Well, you know, the one that struck me as strange was the Iraq Body Count Project. They argued that the Lancet estimate was suspect, quote, because of a very different conclusion reached by another random household survey, the Iraq Living Condition Survey.
And they're wrong about that. That other survey found very similar death toll to our death tolls from our surveys. So
That's what I was going to point out. I thought that was really interesting that they seem to argue something against you, but then pretty much, you know, they're saying, well, we had a larger sample size, you know, we had a considerably better distribution here, and they pretty much found what you found.
That's right. And what Iraq Body Count wasn't thinking about was that there was a survey. It was done by a very good scientist. It was headed by a scientist from Norway, but he didn't actually go to Iraq, so it was done by government workers on the ground. And they found in the first, essentially, year of occupation about 24,000 violent deaths. Our survey would have said something like 37,000 in that same window of time. But, and here's the kicker, they went back to some of the houses, and they knew that they were missing a lot of deaths. They had a crude death rate, less than half of the death rate from nonviolent things that we found, and they knew that was absurdly low. And when they went back to the houses, they discovered that they could get, at least when they just asked about child deaths, about 50% more the second time around. They didn't ask about violent deaths because that had, I guess, become too political at that point in time. I'm not fully sure why they didn't ask. But, in a meeting in Geneva 3 weeks ago, the author of that study presented his results and said, well, he thinks really that the violent death toll could have been as high as 50,000 as of the time of his publishing, and realized the first Lancet study was saying 37,000 in that first same window of time, 13 months. So the two studies are very, very consistent, actually.
Well, Dr. Roberts, what about the Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters? I watched that and I listened closely and paid attention to what they were saying. There was one individual from there, I think from Brussels, of course. She was criticizing the Lancet surveys, your work, and she said that there was some methodology concerns that she had there. She pointed out that the result did not fit with any of her work recorded in the past 15 years of studying conflict zones. She even used Darfur as an example. Because I always hear that argument from people who say, well, this doesn't pan out because in other war zones, you would think this would happen. There would be, you know, people going to other countries in mass, which I think is happening with Iraq, certainly is. People are saying, well, you should have had this occur and then that occur. Well, how much weight do you give those types of individuals who make that claim, saying, well, my experience, last 15 years, this does not coincide with what we should expect?
Well, I don't give it a lot of weight, as I think you probably suspect. As I mentioned in the lead-in here, you know, I think I had worked in seven other really hot war zones beforehand, and five of them, as this woman from Brussels that you're mentioning, Debbie Sapir, has commented, in five of them, disease and the disruption associated with war indirectly killed more people than the violence. So I understand the argument she's making, but in Bosnia, in Kosovo, we had elevated deaths from violence with almost no deaths from nonviolent means, and I think that the Iraqi population was a lot closer to those in Kosovo than to those in Darfur. I mean, it is a well-educated population with a lot of resources. Most households have, you know, cell phones and cars and televisions, and these are not poor people. So in this particular case, I don't put a lot of stock in it, and as you suggest, I think when you have data that just seem wrong, the standard way in science to deal with it is for someone to go out and independently repeat the measuring process and see if you come up with the same thing. And we have asked and asked and asked for this to happen, and it just hasn't. But since the study came out in October, there have been some interesting revelations. The first one was that the British government had assessed the Lancet study when it came out last October in two different parts. The group that does development work for the British government, they assessed it, and the public health scientists within the British military assessed it. And both of them came to the same conclusion, that the method's about as good as you can get in these sorts of settings. And the British military came to the conclusion, if anything, it's an underestimate. And it's very interesting that this story, which was broken by the BBC, must be back around March, didn't get any coverage in the U.S. A separate thing that came out recently was there was a poll that was done by ABC and the BBC at the fourth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And it's available, the summary of the results are still available on the BBC's website. And the first thing they say in there is that 17% of households say they've lost a household member to violence. Now, if you believe Iraq body count, and the Ministry of Health has been saying sort of similar numbers, which we know are just the tip of the iceberg, but if you believe them that only 70 or so thousand people have died by now, well, 70,000, that would be about, let me just think about this.
How many people per year?
1 in 20 households? Yeah, I think it would be around 1 in 20 households that should have lost someone. And our study last summer was saying 1 in 7. And so for the BBC to do a poll that says 17% of households have lost someone to violence is quite consistent with our findings.
I want to say, Dr. Roberts, that Fred Kaplan, the journalist for Slate Magazine,
yes,
you know, he writes the column War Stories. It seems as though that you convinced him. You know, the first survey you did, he was quite critical. The second survey, 2006, he argued that the second survey had some improvements over the first. He said there was a larger sample size. He said it was more fastidious attention to data gathering procedures, and there was a narrower range of uncertainty. So you are, even though he does, in fact, say that there are some questions that Lancet study doesn't really answer, you have won over some people who were quite critical of the first study.
Well, I'm sorry to say that probably there's, unfortunately, other evidence coming out as well. You know, if the Iraq body count and the Ministry of Health tallies are correct, it's only about 1 in 10 deaths over the last 4.5 years have been from violence, because there have to be a certain number, 140,000 or so per year from natural causes. Every population has some people dying every day. It's just part of the life process. And we think in Iraq that would be something in the order of 12,000 a month, 140,000 a year, something like that. So if there have only been 70,000 deaths in the last 4.5 years, that means it's only about 1 in 10 deaths have been from violence. And every shred of evidence we have is that most of the bodies coming into morgues are not from natural causes, but are from violence. So that supports us.
Dr. Roberts, I have a few more questions. No, sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a few more short questions, and I'm going to turn this over because of people who, listeners, callers, who want to ask you questions. But really, really quickly.
Oh, okay, I'll be less verbose then.
Real quickly, what do you think, just a conservative estimate of the number of Iraqis dead as a result of the invasion?
650,000 last summer. I think all evidence is things have only gotten worse, but I am only speculating since then.
Dr. Roberts, if you could vote for George Bush, if George Bush was running and could run, would you vote for him?
No.
Dr. Roberts, are you a Democrat or Republican? I know that you ran for office.
Yeah, I am a registered Democrat, but you know, I wasn't until after I had been to Iraq. All of my life, when I worked for the federal government, I was just not affiliated with any party. I was not a very political guy. But the combination of the debacle in Iraq and the debacle of Hurricane Katrina just put me over the edge. And so, yes, I joined the Democratic Party as a response to this, in fact. But for 20 years of my voting life, I was not associated with any party.
And Dr. Roberts, another question that really just comes off the top of my head is, are you going to vote for a president, and who do you think you would vote for this time around?
I am very, very fond of Dennis Kucinich, and I don't think he has a chance of winning the Democratic primary. So I'm just going to hold my tongue and see how it pans out.
Thank you, Dr. Roberts. I certainly appreciate your coming in. You see, I had to throw some curveballs there. I know you probably didn't anticipate those types of questions. Well, that's what we do here at the People Speak. We're speaking with Dr. Les Roberts, who led a research team in Iraq in 2004 and, in fact, 2006, posted and shared and published studies that, well, the Bush administration and many of those who support Bush didn't particularly care for. Dr. Les Roberts estimates that probably 650,000 conservatively are dead as a result of the invasion of Iraq. And we're going to turn the lines over to individuals who have questions. If you have any questions, please call in. You know the telephone number, I'm quite sure. We have a caller already, Matt from Kansas. Matt, please come and ask your question of Dr. Roberts. Matt, are you there? Well, I guess that Matt is not there. We have another caller, Dari from Connecticut. Dari from Connecticut, please come up and ask your question of Dr. Les Roberts.
Good evening, Dr. Roberts. First of all, thank you for being here. My name is Dari, and I'm from Connecticut. I do the website, my company does, for the People Speak Radio, and we're very, very happy to have you here this evening. My question is, since I'm a very visual person, I'm curious what you saw, if you can tell us what the condition of Iraq was, what the damage was to the infrastructure, what damage you saw in cities, how the living conditions were for the people there. There was something I read once that children actually are doing their homework by candlelight because they don't have enough electricity at night. And I'm very curious what you saw as you traveled around the country. You were fortunate enough to see it with your own eyes. So that's my question. Thank you.
My pleasure. So, Dori, you know, it's funny. In the worst of wars, in the most violent of wars, most people still every day go out and get some water and they make tea and they do all those things that they tend to do because at any one moment, it's only a tiny, tiny fraction of the population that's experiencing intense violence. So the things that I saw that were dramatic were pretty limited. I saw in Sadr City whole blocks that had been obviously shot up, I assume, by cannon or machine gun fire from helicopters, where as you looked at painted walls, like half the paint would be gone from the pockmarks associated with this fire that had hit the concrete walls. And the light posts had been so damaged they would fall over, having lost their integrity. So I only saw a couple of places like that, but realized that was 2004. And I imagine that things have not improved. I was struck that a lot of construction projects, both from Saddam's era and that had been started by the Americans, were abandoned in the middle of them. You would be driving on the road and you would see large diameter pipe that was there, obviously, to drain sewage that was ponding up in a neighborhood of Baghdad. And I'd ask my driver, and he'd say, oh, that's been sitting here now more than a year because they don't dare work on it. It's too dangerous for them. So that was very noticeable. At night, people aren't out on the streets like I'm told they used to be. Just in the big cities, in the towns where I went, the mobility of people at night was very, very curtailed. People were driving like maniacs because they were afraid of being carjacked. They were afraid of violence. They were afraid of coalition vehicles who, I understand at the time, had orders not to stop at intersections because they might get shot by snipers, so they rolled through intersections no matter what the light or the controlling policeman might do. So the answer to your question is the country didn't look devastated by war. There were little pockets of it, but the country looked like all the projects had just been dropped in the middle and people had gone off to do something else.
Thank you, Dari from Connecticut. Matt from Kansas is back on the line. Matt from Kansas, please ask your question of Dr. Les Roberts.
Yes, doctor. My question is this. What kind of disease are we dealing with over there in the Iraqi war, why the war is going off? If you could explain this to the people that don't know the repercussions.
Well, in the first Gulf War, probably more people died of diarrhea than died of bullets and bombs. At least, I'm sorry, non-combatants probably died of diarrhea than bullets and bombs. The water systems were destroyed. A bunch of people, Kurds mostly, ran up to the northern part of the country, and Turkey wouldn't let them in. And 16,000 people died there in just a couple of week period, mostly from diarrheal diseases. This time around, I'm told there have been a couple of little outbreaks of cholera, but there actually have not been any major disease outbreaks. People are dying of heart attacks and strokes and car accidents and all those things they're dying of in Kansas. And we haven't seen that dramatic a rise in infectious disease death rates, even though everyone predicted it in advance, and I expected it in advance, but it hasn't come into being yet.
Thank you, Matt from Kansas. We have another caller, Mike from California. Mike, please ask your question of Dr. Les Roberts.
Thank you very much. Hello, Dr. Roberts. Dr. Roberts, within the last few months, I read a story about the horrible conditions in Baghdad in which children can be seen scavenging on garbage dumps for food.
That's right.
Of parents giving their children away to strangers. In order to try and save their lives because they can't afford or can't feed or take care of them. Is that something new or was that present when you were there in Iraq? Thank you.
I can't answer about giving children away. You know, I'm not a fluent Arabic speaker. That didn't come up. I didn't encounter that. I saw children picking over garbage in many different places, especially in the dumps north of Baghdad while I was there. So that has been going on. And I gather from my friends in Iraq, who I communicate with on at least a weekly basis, that really things have gotten a lot worse. The unemployment estimates put out by polls haven't really changed over the last couple of years. It keeps saying 40% of men are unemployed, but I sense from my friends that financial desperation is creeping in. And in particular, the first wave of people that started fleeing Iraq after the Golden Dome was bombed, I'm told, tended to be relatively affluent. It was doctors and lawyers and people that would feel they would be targets and would have connections and resources if they could go to Egypt or somewhere else and work. And my friends tell me of late, a lot of people are just scrounging, selling what little they have just in order to get a bus ticket and to get out and try to get into Syria. And so I think there is evolving to be a desperately poor portion of the society. So I find what you say plausible. I didn't see evidence of it. But I do know that there was an estimate just a little bit ago that there were 900,000 orphans in Iraq, children who've lost a parent and need assistance. And that's sort of consistent with the environment you're describing.
Thank you, Mike, from California. Caller from California. We have another caller, Steve from New Mexico. Steve, please ask your question of Dr. Les Roberts.
Dr. Roberts, first of all, I'd like to thank you, sir, for doing a job, as you pointed out when early on, that was a very dangerous job, one that needed to be done. And thank you for having the intestinal fortitude to do that. I'm wondering why. You know why it is that our government and other governments don't want us to know the real figures. They don't want us to know what's really going on there. I imagine it's because if we did know, we would definitely do something until we got out. And I think that's what they're trying to postpone. The horror of it, the horror of war. I think Americans should have to suffer the horror of their war, and that includes the totals. And again, thank you, sir, for doing a job that was very dangerous.
Well, Steve, my pleasure. And just one, there wasn't really a question there, so I'll just make a comment. It is striking to me how different the U.S. media is covering this war compared to the Canadian or the British media. In particular, a dramatic example was that poll I mentioned in March of this year, done at the fourth anniversary of the invasion, was done by ABC and BBC simultaneously. The headline, if you go to the ABC website, of the poll is "A Better Life Poll: Most Iraqis Ambivalent About the War, But Not About Its Results." The exact same poll on the BBC website is entitled "Optimism Fades in Iraq." And the BBC summary starts out with that number I gave you, 17% of households have lost someone. That's not even mentioned in the ABC coverage of the exact same poll. So the failure of telling the story of what's going on in Iraq needs to fall on the media as well.
Thank you, Steve, from New Mexico. We have about a minute, and we're going to try to squeeze in this last caller. Last caller, of course, is Dari from Connecticut. She's back again. She has a quick question for you, Dr. Roberts. Go ahead, Dari, ask your question.
Thank you very much again. I have a question from one of our audience members. His name is Agram, and he's from France. He wants to know if you have any idea, money-wise, of how much art or money and other things were stolen from Iraq since the invasion, not by anarchists, but from other governments involved in the invasion. Like, we have seen many stolen objects in museums all over the world. It happened in Egypt and other places. That's my question.
Well, I'm sorry, Dari, but actually I have no later information about that. We did a really narrow study about deaths in households, and I'm afraid that's all I'm really qualified to speak to with any detail.
Dr. Roberts, I want to thank you for joining us in the People Speak. Real quick, I want to know, are you doing another study, and how soon?
So, my graduate class in in essentially epidemiology of human rights, has just done a telephone survey in Iraq. And they called up people in Baghdad and asked them to describe the 10 violent deaths nearest to their house since the war began. And we went onto Iraq Body Count's website and into the internet and tried to find out, of the deaths that were reported, how many were covered in the media. And so we have a study that's coming out soon that will say, even in Baghdad, the vast majority of violent deaths are not covered by the press.
Wow.
So that's the only study we have coming out in the near future. But I think it helps get to some of the points your listeners were bringing up about the stories not getting out, and it will give us a chance to educate the press a little bit about the performance.
Well, Dr. Roberts, we shall be looking for that particular publication of that particular survey. Dr. Roberts estimated the number of Iraqis dead as a result of the coalition forces invasion, and he's basically right here on The People Speak. I thank you very much, Dr. Les Roberts, for being here with us.
Malik, it's been nice to be with you.
Thank you. You take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the seawall by the relief fortress, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.